Certain things are better lost than found. He bade Johnny good night and left quietly. Johnny was very tired now, but still sleep did not come for a long time.
Chapter 9 1 Johnny's first surgery was scheduled for May 28th. Both Wysak and Brown had explained the procedure carefully to him. He would be given a local anesthetic. Neither of them felt a general could be risked. The first operation would be on his knees and ankles. His own ligaments, which had shortened during his long sleep, would be lengthened with a combination of plastic wonder fibers. The plastic to be used was also employed in heart valve bypass surgery. The question was not so much one of his body's acceptance or rejection of the artificial ligaments, Brown told him, as it was a question of his leg's ability to adjust to the change. If they had good results with the knees and the ankles, three more operations were on the boards, one on the long ligaments of his thighs, one on the elbow strap ligaments, and possibly a third on his neck, which he could barely turn at all. The surgery was to be performed by Raymond Rupp, who had pioneered the technique. He was flying in from San Francisco. "What does this guy Rupp want with me, if he's such a superstar?" Johnny asked. Superstar was a word he'd learned from Marie. She had used it in connection with a balding, bespectacled singer with the unlikely name of Elton John. "You're underestimating your own superstar qualities," Brown answered. "There are only a handful of people in the United States who have recovered from comas as long as yours was. And of that handful, your recovery from the accompanying brain damage has been the most radical and pleasing." Sam Wysak was more blunt. "You're a guinea pig, no?"
"What?"
"Yes. Look into the light, please."
Wysak shone a light into the pupil of Johnny's left eye. "Did you know I can look right at your optic nerve with this thing?"
"Yes. The eyes are more than the windows of the soul. They are one of the brain's most crucial maintenance points."
"Guinea pig," Johnny said morosely, staring into the savage point of light.
"Yes," the light snapped off. "Don't feel so sorry for yourself. Many of the techniques to be employed in your behalf, and some of those already employed, were perfected during the Vietnam War. No shortage of guinea pigs in the VA hospitals, no? A man like Rob is interested in you because you are unique. Here is a man who has slept 4.5 years. Can we make him walk again? An interesting problem. He sees the monograph he will write on it for the New England Journal of Medicine. He looks forward to it the way a child looks forward to new toys under the Christmas tree. He does not see you. He does not see Johnny Smith in his pain. Johnny Smith, who must take the bedpan and ring for the nurse to scratch if his back itches.
That's good.
His hands will not shake. Smile, Johnny. This Rob looks like a bank clerk, but he is maybe the best surgeon in North America.
But it was hard for Johnny to smile. He had read his way dutifully through the tracks his mother had left him. They depressed him and left him frightened all over again for her sanity. One of them, by a man named Salem Kerbin, struck him as nearly pagan in its loving contemplation of a bloody apocalypse and the yawning barbecue pits of hell. Another described the coming Antichrist in pulp horror terms. The others were a dark carnival of craziness. Christ was living under the South Pole. God drove flying saucers. New York was Sodom, L.A. was Gomorrah. They dealt with exorcism, with witches, with all manner of things seen and unseen. It was impossible for him to reconcile the pamphlets with the religious, yet earthy woman he had known before his coma. 3 days after the incident involving Wysak's snapshot of his mother, a slim and dark-haired reporter from the Bangor Daily News named David Bright showed up at the door of Johnny's room and asked if he could have a short interview.
"Have you asked the doctors?" Johnny asked.
Bright grinned. "Actually, no."
"All right," Johnny said. "In that case, I'd be happy to talk to you."
"You're a man after my own heart," Bright said. He came in and sat down.
His first questions were about the accident and about Johnny's thoughts and feelings upon slipping out of a coma and discovering he had misplaced nearly half a decade. Johnny answered these questions honestly and straightforwardly. Then Bright told him that he had heard from a source
that Johnny had gained some sort of sixth sense as a result of the accident.
Are you asking me if I'm psychic?
Bright smiled and shrugged.
That'll do for a start.
Johnny had thought carefully about the things Wyzak had said. The more he thought, the more it seemed to him that Wyzak had done exactly the right thing when he hung up the phone without saying anything. Johnny had begun to associate it in his mind with that W.W. Jacobs story, The Monkey's Paw. The paw was for wishing, but the price you paid for each of your three wishes was a black one. The old couple had wished for 100 pounds and had lost their son in a mill accident. The mill's compensation had come to exactly 100 pounds. Then the old woman had wished for her son back, and he had come, but before she could open the door and see what a horror she had summoned out of its grave, the old man had used the last wish to send it back. As Wyzak had said, maybe some things were better lost than found.
No, he said, I'm no more psychic than you are.
According to my source, you...
No, it isn't true.
Bright smiled a trifle cynically, seemed to debate pressing the matter further, then turned to a fresh page in his notebook. He began to ask about Johnny's prospects for the future, his feelings about the road back, and Johnny also answered these questions as honestly as he could.
So, what are you going to do when you get out of here? Bright asked, closing his notebook.
I haven't really thought about that. I'm still trying to adjust to the idea that Gerald Ford is the president.
Bright laughed. You're not alone in that, my friend.
I suppose I'll go back to teaching. It's all I know. But right now, that's too far ahead to think about.
Bright thanked him for the interview and left. The article appeared in the paper 2 days later, the day before his leg surgery. It was on the bottom of the front page, and the headline read, John Smith, Modern Rip Van Winkle Faces Long Road Back. There were three pictures, one of them Johnny's picture for the Cleves Mills High School yearbook. It had been taken barely a week before the accident. A picture of Johnny in his hospital bed, looking thin and twisted, with his arms and legs in their bent positions. Between these two was a picture of the almost totally demolished taxi, lying on its side like a dead dog. There was no mention in Bright's article of sixth senses, precognitive powers, or wild talents.
How did you turn him off the ESP angle? Wyzak asked him that evening.
Johnny shrugged. He seemed like a nice guy. Maybe he didn't want to stick me with it.
Maybe not, Wyzak said. But he won't forget it. Not if he's a good reporter, and I understand that he is.
You understand?
I asked around.
Looking out for my best interests?
We all do what we can, no?
Are you nervous about tomorrow, Johnny?
Not nervous, no. Scared is a more accurate word.
Yes, of course you are. I would be.
Will you be there?
Yes, in the observation section of the operating theater, above. You won't be able to tell me from the others in my greens, but I will be there.
Wear something, Johnny said. Wear something so I'll know it's you.
Wyzak looked at him and smiled.
All right, I'll pin my watch to my tunic.
Good, Johnny said. What about Dr. Brown? Will he be there?
Dr. Brown is in Washington. Tomorrow he will present you to the American Society of Neurologists.
I have read his paper. It is quite good. Perhaps overstated.
You weren't invited?
Wyzak shrugged.
I don't like to fly. That is something that scares me.
And maybe you wanted to stay here?
Wyzak smiled crookedly, spread his hands, and said nothing.
He doesn't like me much, does he? Johnny asked.
Dr. Brown.
No, not much, Wyzak said. He thinks you are having us on, making things up for some reason of your own.
Seeking attention, perhaps?
Don't judge him solely on that, John. His cast of mind makes it impossible for him to think otherwise. If you feel anything for Jim, feel a little pity. He is a brilliant man, and he will go far. Already he has offers, and someday soon he will fly from these cold north woods, and Bangor will see him no more. He will go to Houston or Hawaii or possibly even to Paris. But he is curiously limited. He is a mechanic of the brain. He has cut it to pieces with his scalpel and found no soul. Therefore there is none. Like the Russian astronauts who circled the Earth and did not see God. It is the empiricism of the mechanic, and a mechanic is only a child with superior motor control.
You must never tell him I said that.
No. And now you must rest. Tomorrow you have a long day.
2. All Johnny saw of the world-famous Dr. Rupp during the operation was a pair of thick, horn-rimmed glasses and a large wen at the extreme left of the man's forehead. The rest of him was capped, gowned, and gloved. Johnny had been given 2 pre-op injections, one of Demerol and one of atropine, and when he was wheeled in, he was as high as a kite. The anesthetist approached with the biggest Novocaine needle Johnny had ever seen in his life. He expected that the injection would hurt, and he was not wrong. He was injected between L4 and L5, the 4th and 5th lumbar vertebrae, high enough up to avoid the cauda equina, that bundle of nerves at the base of the spine that vaguely resembles a horse's tail. Johnny lay on his stomach and bit his arm to keep from screaming. After an endless time, the pain began to fade to a dull sensation of pressure. Otherwise, the lower half of his body was totally gone. Rupp's face loomed over him. The green bandit, Johnny thought. Jesse James in horn rims. Your money or your life.
Are you comfortable, Mr. Smith? Rupp asked.
Yes, but I'd just as soon not go through that again.
You may read magazines if you like, or you may watch in the mirror if you feel it will not upset you.
All right.
Nurse, give me a blood pressure, please.
120 over 76, doctor.
That's lovely. Well, group, shall we begin?
Save me a drumstick, Johnny said weakly, and was surprised by the hearty laughter.
Rupp patted his sheet-covered shoulder with one thinly gloved hand. He watched Rupp select a scalpel and disappear behind the green drapes hung over the metal hoop that curved above Johnny. The mirror was convex, and Johnny had a fairly good, if slightly distorted, view of everything.
Oh, yes, Rupp said. Oh, yes, dee-dee-dee, here's what we want. Hum-dee-hum, okay. Clamp, please. Nurse, come on, wake up for Christ's sake. Yes, sir. Now, I believe I'd like one of those. No, hold it. Don't give me what I asked for, give me what I need. Yes, okay. Strap, please.
With forceps, the nurse handed Rupp something that looked like a bundle of thin wires twisted together. Rupp picked them delicately out of the air with tweezers.
Like an Italian dinner, Johnny thought. And look at all that spaghetti sauce.
That was what made him feel ill, and he looked away. Above him in the gallery, the rest of the bandit gang looked down at him. Their eyes looked pale and merciless and frightening. And then he spotted Wyzak, third from the right, his watch pinned neatly to the front of his gown. Johnny nodded. Wyzak nodded back. That made it a little better. 3.
Rupp finished the connections between his knees and calves, and Johnny was turned over. Things continued. The anesthesiologist asked him if he felt all right. Johnny told her he thought he felt as well as possible under the circumstances. She asked him if he would like to listen to a tape, and he said that would be very nice. A few moments later, the clear, sweet voice of Joan Baez filled the operating room. Rupp did his thing. Johnny grew sleepy and dozed off. When he woke up, the operation was still going on. Wyzak was still there. Johnny raised one hand, acknowledging his presence, and Wyzak nodded again. 4. An hour later, it was done. He was wheeled into a recovery room, where a nurse kept asking him if he could tell her how many of his toes she was touching. After a while, Johnny could. Rupp came in, his bandit's mask hanging off to one side. All right? He asked.
Yes.
It went very well, Rupp said. I'm optimistic.
Good.
You'll have some pain, Rupp said. Quite a lot of it, perhaps. The therapy itself will give you a lot of pain at first. Stick with it.
Stick with it, Johnny muttered.
Good afternoon, Rupp said,
and left. Probably, Johnny thought, to play a quick nine on the local golf course before it got too dark. 5.
Quite a lot of pain.
By 9 p.m., the last of the local had worn off, and Johnny was in agony. He was forbidden to move his legs without the help of two nurses. It felt as if nail-studded belts had been looped around his knees and then cinched cruelly tight. Time slowed to an inchworm's crawl. He would glance at his watch, sure that an hour had passed since the last time he'd looked at it, and would see instead that it had only been 4 minutes. He became sure he couldn't stand the pain for another minute. Then the minute would pass, and he would become sure he couldn't stand it for another minute. He thought of all the minutes stacked up ahead like coins in a slot 5 miles high, and the blackest depression he had ever known swept over him in a smooth, solid wave and carried him down. They were going to torture him to death. Operations on his elbows, thighs, his neck, therapy, walkers, wheelchairs, canes. You're going to have pain. Stick with it. No, you stick with it, Johnny thought. Just leave me alone. Don't come near me again with your butcher's knives. If this is your idea of helping, I want no part of it. Steady throbbing pain, digging into the meat of him. Warmth on his belly, trickling. He had wet himself. Johnny Smith turned his face toward the wall and cried. 6. 10 days after that first operation, and 2 weeks before the next one was scheduled, Johnny looked up from the book he was reading, Woodward and Bernstein's All the President's Men, and saw Sarah standing in the doorway, looking at him hesitantly. Sarah, he said, it is you, isn't it? She let out her breath shakily. Yes, it's me, Johnny. He put the book down and looked at her. She was smartly dressed in a light green linen dress, and she held a small, brown clutch bag in front of her like a shield. She'd put a streak in her hair, and it looked good. It also made him feel a sharp and twisting stab of jealousy. Had it been her idea, or that of the man she lived and slept with? She was beautiful. Come in, he said. Come in and sit down. She crossed the room, and suddenly he saw himself as she must see him. Too thin, his body slumped a little to one side in the chair by the window. His legs stuck out straight on the hassock, dressed in a Johnny and a cheap hospital bathrobe. As you can see, I put on my tux, he said. You look fine. She kissed his cheek, and 100 memories shuffled brightly through his mind like a doubled pack of cards. She sat in the other chair, crossed her legs, and tugged at the hem of her dress. They looked at each other without saying anything. He saw that she was very nervous. If someone were to touch her on the shoulder, she would probably spring right out of her seat.
I didn't know if I should come, she said, but I really wanted to.
I'm glad you did.
Like strangers on a bus, he thought dismally. It's got to be more than this, doesn't it?
So how are you doing? She asked. He smiled. I've been in the war. Want to see my battle scars? He raised his gown over his knees, showing the S-shaped incisions that were now beginning to heal. They were still red and hash-marked with stitches.
Oh, my lord, what are they doing to you?
They're trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, Johnny said. All the king's horses, all the king's men, and all the king's doctors. So I guess... And then he stopped, because she was crying.
Don't say it like that, Johnny, she said. Please don't say it like that. I'm sorry. It was just... I was trying to joke about it.
Was that it? Had he been trying to laugh it off? Or had it been a way of saying, thanks for coming to see me, they're cutting me to pieces?
Can you? Can you joke about it?
She'd gotten a Kleenex from the clutch bag and was wiping her eyes with it. Not very often. I guess seeing you again, the defenses go up, Sarah.
Are they going to let you out of here?
Eventually. It's like running the gauntlet in the old days. Did you ever read about that? If I'm still alive after every Indian in the tribe has had a swing at me with his tomahawk, I get to go free.
This summer?
No, I don't think so.
I'm so sorry it happened, she said,
so low he could barely hear her.
I try to figure out why, or how things could have been changed, and it just robs me of sleep. If I hadn't eaten that bad hot dog, if you had stayed instead of going back.
She shook her head and looked at him, her eyes red.
It seems sometimes there's no percentage.
Johnny smiled. 00. House spin. Hey, you remember that? I clobbered that wheel, Sarah.
Yes. He won over $500.
He looked at her, still smiling, but now the smile was puzzled, wounded almost. You want to know something funny? My doctors think maybe the reason I lived was because I had some sort of head injury when I was young, but I couldn't remember any, and neither could my mom and dad. But it seems like every time I think of it, I flash on that wheel of fortune, and I smell like burning rubber.
Maybe you were in a car accident?
She began doubtfully.
No, I don't think that's it. But it's like the wheel was my warning, and I ignored it.
She shifted a little and said uneasily,
Don't, Johnny.
He shrugged. Or maybe it was just that I used up 4 years of luck in one evening.
But look at this, Sarah.
Carefully, painfully, he took one leg off the hassock, bent it to a 90-degree angle, then stretched it out on the hassock again.
Maybe they can put Humpty back together again. When I woke up, I couldn't do that. And I couldn't get my legs to straighten out as much as they are now, either.
And you can think, Johnny, she said. You can talk. We all thought that, you know. Yeah, Johnny the turnip. A silence fell between them again, awkward and heavy. Johnny broke it by saying with forced brightness,
So how's by you?
Well, I'm married. I guess you knew that.
Dad told me.
He's such a fine man, Sarah said. And then, in a burst,
I couldn't wait, Johnny. I'm sorry about that, too. The doctor said you'd never come out of it, and you'd get lower and lower until you just slipped away. And even if I had known...
She looked up at him with an uneasy expression of defense on her face.
Even if I'd known, Johnny, I don't think I could have waited. 4.5 years is a long time.
Yeah, it is, he said. That's a hell of a long time. You want to hear something morbid? I got them to bring me 4 years' worth of news magazines just so I could see who died. Truman, Janis Joplin, Jimi Hendrix. Jesus, I thought of him doing Purple Haze and I could hardly believe it. Dan Blocker. And you and me. We just slipped away.
I feel so bad about it, she said, nearly whispering. So damn guilty. But I love the guy, Johnny. I love him a lot. Okay? That's what matters.
His name is Walt Hazlitt, and he's a...
I think I'd rather hear about your kid, Johnny said. No offense, huh?
He's a peach, she said, smiling. He's 7 months old now. His name is Dennis, but we call him Denny. He's named after his paternal grandfather.
Bring him in sometime. I'd like to see him.
I will, Sarah said. And they smiled at each other falsely, knowing that nothing of the kind was ever going to happen.
Johnny, is there anything else you need?
Only you, babe. And the last 4.5 years back again.
Nah, he said. You still teaching?
Still teaching. For a while yet, she agreed.
Still snorting that wicked cocaine?
Oh, Johnny, you haven't changed. Same old tease.
Same old tease, he agreed. And the silence fell between them again, with an almost audible thump.
Can I come see you again?
Sure, he said. That would be fine, Sarah.
He hesitated, not wanting it to end so inconclusively, not wanting to hurt her or himself if it could be avoided,
wanting to say something honest.
Sarah, he said. You did the right thing.
Did I? She asked. She smiled, and it trembled at the corners of her mouth. I wonder. It all seems so cruel, and I can't help it, so wrong. I love my husband and my baby, and when Walt says that someday we're going to be living in the finest house in Bangor, I believe him. He says someday he's going to run for Bill Cohen's seat in the House, and I believe that too. He says someday someone from Maine is going to be elected president, and I can almost believe that. And I come in here and look at your poor legs. She was beginning to cry again now. They look like they went through a mixmaster or something, and you're so thin. No, Sarah, don't. You're so thin, and it seems wrong and cruel, and I hate it. I hate it. Because it isn't right at all. None of it. Sometimes nothing is right, I guess, he said. Tough old world. Sometimes you just have to do what you can and try to live with it. You go and be happy, Sarah. And if you want to come and see me, come on and come. Bring a cribbage board. I will, she said. I'm sorry to cry. Not very cheery for you, huh? It's all right, he said, and smiled. You want to get off that cocaine, baby. Your nose will fall off. She laughed a little. Same old Johnny, she said. Suddenly she bent and kissed his mouth. Oh, Johnny, be well soon. He looked at her thoughtfully as she drew away. Johnny, you didn't leave it, he said. No, you didn't leave it at all. Leave what? She was frowning in puzzlement. Your wedding ring. You didn't leave it in Montreal. He had put his hand up to his forehead and was rubbing the patch of skin over his right eye with his fingers. His arm cast a shadow, and she saw with something very like superstitious fear that his face was half light, half dark. It made her think of the Halloween mask he had scared her with. She and Walt had honeymooned in Montreal. But how could Johnny know that? Unless maybe Herb had told him. Yes, that was most certainly it. But only she and Walt knew that she had lost her wedding ring somewhere in the hotel room. No one else knew because he had bought her another ring before they flew home. She had been too embarrassed to tell anyone, even her mother. How? Johnny frowned deeply, then smiled at her. His hand fell away from his forehead and clasped its mate in his lap. It wasn't sized right, he said. You were packing, don't you remember, Sarah? He was out buying something, and you were packing. He was out buying, don't know. It's in the dead zone.
Dead zone?
He went out to a novelty shop and bought a whole bunch of silly stuff as souvenirs. Whoopee cushions and things like that. But Johnny, how could you know I lost my ring?
You were packing.
The ring wasn't sized right. It was a lot too big. You were going to have it taken care of when you got back. But in the meantime, you...
That puzzled frown began to return, then cleared immediately. He smiled at her.
You stuffed it with toilet paper.
There was no question about the fear now. It was coiling lazily in her stomach like cold water. Her hand crept up to her throat, and she stared at him, nearly hypnotized.
He's got the same look in his eyes, that same cold, amused look that he had when he was beating the wheel that night. What's happened to you, Johnny? What are you?
The blue of his eyes had darkened to a near violet, and he seemed far away. She wanted to run. The room itself seemed to be darkening, as if he were somehow tearing the fabric of reality, pulling apart the links between past and present.
It slipped off your finger, he said. You were putting his shaving stuff into one of those side pockets, and it just slipped off. You didn't notice you'd lost it until later, and so you thought it was somewhere in the room.
He laughed, and it was a high, tinkling, tripping sound. Not like Johnny's usual laugh at all, but cold. Cold.
Boy, you two turned that room upside down. But you packed it. It's still in that suitcase pocket. All this time. You go up in the attic and look, Sarah. You'll see.
In the corridor outside, someone dropped a water glass or something and cursed in surprise when it broke. Johnny glanced toward the sound, and his eyes cleared. He looked back, saw her frozen, wide-eyed face, and frowned with concern.
What?
Sarah, did I say something wrong?
How did you know? She whispered. How could you know those things?
I don't know, he said. Sarah, I'm sorry if I... Johnny, I ought to go. Denny's with the sitter.
All right, Sarah. I'm sorry I upset you. How could you know about my ring, Johnny?
He could only shake his head.
7. Halfway down the first floor corridor, her stomach began to feel strange. She found the ladies just in time. She hurried in, closed the door of one of the stalls, and threw up violently. She flushed, and then stood with her eyes closed, shivering, but also close to laughter. The last time she had seen Johnny, she had thrown up too. Rough justice, brackets in time like bookends. She put her hands over her mouth to stifle whatever might be trying to get out, laughter, or maybe a scream. And in the darkness, the world seemed to tilt irrationally, like a dish, like a spinning wheel of fortune. 8. She had left Denny with Mrs. LaBelle, so when she got home, the house was silent and empty. She went up the narrow stairway to the attic and turned the switch that controlled the two bare, dangling light bulbs. Their luggage was stacked up in one corner, the Montreal travel stickers still pasted to the sides of the orange Grant's suitcases. There were three of them. She opened the first, felt through the elasticized side pouches, and found nothing. Likewise the second, likewise the third. She drew in a deep breath and then let it out, feeling foolish and a little disappointed, but mostly relieved, overwhelmingly relieved. No ring. Sorry, Johnny. But on the other hand, I'm not sorry at all. It would have been just a little bit too spooky. She started to slide the suitcases back into place between a tall pile of Walt's old college texts and the floor lamp that crazy woman's dog had knocked over and which Sarah had never had the heart to throw out. And as she dusted off her hands preparatory to putting the whole thing behind her, a small voice far inside her whispered, almost too low to hear. Sort of a flying search, wasn't it? Didn't really want to find anything, did you, Sarah? No. No, she really hadn't wanted to find anything. And if that little voice thought she was going to open all those suitcases again, it was crazy. She was 15 minutes late in picking up Denny. Walt was bringing home one of the senior partners in his firm for dinner, a very big deal, and she owed Betty Hackman a letter from the Peace Corps in Uganda. Betty had gone directly into marriage with the son of a staggeringly rich Kentucky horse breeder. Also, she ought to clean both bathrooms, set her hair, and give Denny a bath. There was really too much to do to be frigging around up in this hot, dirty attic. So she pulled all three suitcases open again, and this time she searched the side pockets very carefully. And tucked, all the way down in the corner of the third suitcase, she found her wedding ring. She held it up to the glare of one of the naked bulbs and read the engraving inside, still as fresh as it had been on the day Walt slipped the ring on her finger. Walter and Sarah Hazlitt, July 9th, 1972. Sarah looked at it for a long time. Then she put the suitcases back, turned off the lights, and went back downstairs. She changed out of the linen dress, which was now streaked with dust, and into slacks and a light top. She went down the block to Mrs. LaBelle's and picked up her son, then went home, and Sarah put Denny in the living room, where he crawled around vigorously while she prepared the roast and peeled some potatoes. With the roast in the oven, she went into the living room and saw that Denny had gone to sleep on the rug. She picked him up and put him in his crib. Then she began to clean the toilets, and in spite of everything, in spite of the way the clock was racing toward dinner time, her mind never left the ring. Johnny had known. She could even pinpoint the moment he'd come by his knowledge.
when she had kissed him before leaving. Just thinking about him made her feel weak and strange, and she wasn't sure why. It was all mixed up. His crooked smile, so much the same. His body so terribly changed, so slight and undernourished. The lifeless way his hair lay against his scalp, contrasting so blindingly with the rich memories she still held of him. She had wanted to kiss him. "Stop it," she muttered to herself. Her face in the bathroom mirror looked like a stranger's face, flushed and hot and, let's face it, gang, sexy. Her hand closed on the ring in the pocket of her slacks, and almost, but not quite, before she was aware of what she was going to do, she had thrown it into the clean, slightly blue water of the toilet bowl. All sparkly clean so that if Mr. Treaches of Baribault, Treaches, Morehouse, and Gendron had to take a leak sometime during the dinner party, he wouldn't be offended by any unsightly ring around the bowl. Who knows what roadblocks may stand in the way of a young man on his march toward the councils of the mighty, right? Who knows anything in this world? It made a tiny splash and sank slowly to the bottom of the clear water, turning lazily over and over. She thought she heard a small clink when it struck the porcelain at the bottom, but that was probably just imagination. Her head throbbed. The attic had been hot and stale and musty. But Johnny's kiss, that had been sweet. So sweet. Before she could think about what she was doing, and thus allow reason to reassert itself, she reached out and flushed the toilet. It went with a bang and a roar. It seemed louder, maybe, because her eyes were squeezed shut. When she opened them, the ring was gone. It had been lost, and now it was lost again. Suddenly, her legs felt weak, and she sat down on the edge of the tub and put her hands over her face. Her hot, hot face. She wouldn't go back and see Johnny again. It wasn't a good idea. It had upset her. Walt was bringing home a senior partner, and she had a bottle of Mondavi and a budget-fracturing roast. Those were the things she would think about. She should be thinking about how much she loved Walt and about Denny asleep in his crib. She should think about how, when she made your choices in this crazy world, you had to live with them, and she would not think about Johnny Smith and his crooked, charming smile anymore. 9. The dinner that night was a great success. Chapter 10. 1. The doctor put Vera Smith on a blood pressure drug called hydrodiuretic. It didn't lower her blood pressure much, not a dime's worth, she was fond of writing in her letters, but it did make her feel sick and weak. She had to sit down and rest after vacuuming the floor. Climbing a flight of stairs made her stop at the top and pant like a doggy on a hot August afternoon. If Johnny hadn't told her it was for the best, she would have thrown the pills out the window right then. The doctor tried her on another drug, and that made her heart race so alarmingly that she did stop taking it. "This is a trial-and-error procedure," the doctor said. "We'll get you fixed up eventually, Vera. Don't worry."
"I don't worry," Vera said. "My faith is in the Lord God."
"Yes, of course it is. Just as it should be, too." By the end of June, the doctor had settled on a combination of hydrodiuretic and another drug called Aldomet. Fat, yellow, expensive pills, nasty things. When she started taking the two drugs together, it seemed like she had to make water every 15 minutes. She had headaches. She had heart palpitations. The doctor said her blood pressure was down into the normal range again, but she didn't believe him.
What good were doctors anyway? Look what they were doing to her Johnny. Cutting him up like butcher's meat. 3 operations already. He looked like a monster with stitches all over his arms and legs and neck. And he still couldn't get around without one of those walkers like old Mrs. Sylvester had to use. If her blood pressure was down, why does she feel so crummy all the time?
"You've got to give your body time to get used to the medication," Johnny said. It was the first Saturday in July, and his parents were up for the weekend. Johnny had just come back from hydrotherapy, and he looked pale and haggard. In each hand he held a small lead ball, and he was raising them and lowering them into his lap as they talked, flexing his elbows, building up his biceps and triceps. The healing scars, which ran like slash marks across his elbows and forearms, expanded and contracted.
"Put your faith in God, Johnny," Vera said. "There's no need of all this foolishness. Put your faith in God, and he'll heal you."
"Vera," Herb began.
"Don't you Vera me. This is foolishness. Doesn't the Bible say, 'Ask, and it shall be given. Knock, and it shall be opened unto you'? There's no need for me to take that evil medicine, and no need for my boy to let those doctors go on torturing him. It's wrong. It's not helping, and it's sinful."
Johnny put the balls of lead shot on the bed. The muscles in his arms were trembling. He felt sick to his stomach and exhausted and suddenly furious at his mother.
"The Lord helps those who help themselves," he said. "You don't want the Christian God at all, Mom. You want a magic genie that's going to come out of a bottle and give you 3 wishes."
"Johnny!"
"Well, it's true. Those doctors put that idea in your head. All of these crazy ideas." Her lips were trembling, her eyes wide but tearless. "God brought you out of that coma to do his will, John. These others, they're just..."
"Just trying to get me back on my feet so I won't have to do God's will from a wheelchair the rest of my life." "Let's not have an argument," Herb said. "Families shouldn't argue.
And hurricanes shouldn't blow, but they do every year, and nothing he could say was going to stop this. It had been coming."
"If you put your trust in God, Johnny," Vera began, taking no notice of Herb at all.
"I don't trust anything anymore."
"I'm sorry to hear you say that," she said. Her voice was stiff and distant.
"Satan's agents are everywhere. They'll try to turn you from your destiny. Looks like they are getting along with it real well. You have to make some kind of eternal thing out of it, don't you? I'll tell you what it was. It was a stupid accident. A couple of kids were dragging, and I just happened to get turned into dog meat. You know what I want, Mom? I want to get out of here. That's all I want. And I want you to go on taking your medicine and try to get your feet back on the ground. That's all I want."
"I'm leaving." She stood up. Her face was pale and drawn.
"I'll pray for you, Johnny."
He looked at her, helpless, frustrated, and unhappy. His anger was gone. He had taken it out on her.
"Keep taking your medicine," he said. "I'll pray that you see the light."
She left the room, her face set and as grim as stone. Johnny looked helplessly at his father.
"John, I wish you hadn't done that," Herb said. "I'm tired. It doesn't do a thing for my judgment or my temper."
"Yeah," Herb said. He seemed about to say more and didn't.
"Is she still planning to go out to California for that flying saucer symposium or whatever it is?"
"Yes, but she may change her mind. You never know one day to the next, and it's still a month away."
"You ought to do something."
"Yeah, what? Put her away? Commit her?"
Johnny shook his head.
"I don't know. But maybe it's time you thought about that seriously, instead of just acting like it's out of the question.
She's sick. You have to see that."
Herb said loudly.
"She was all right before you..."
Johnny winced, as if slapped.
"Look,
I'm sorry. John, I didn't mean that."
"Okay, Dad."
"No, I really didn't." Herb's face was a picture of misery.
"Look, I ought to go after her. She's probably leafleting the hallways by now."
"Okay. Johnny, just try to forget this and concentrate on getting well. She does love you, and so do I. Don't be hard on us."
"No, it's all right, Dad."
Herb kissed Johnny's cheek. "I have to go after her."
"All right."
Herb left. When they were gone, Johnny got up and tottered the 3 steps between his chair and the bed. Not much, but something. A start. He wished more than his father knew that he hadn't blown up at his mother like that. He wished it because an odd sort of certainty was growing in him that his mother was not going to live much longer. 2. Vera stopped taking her medication. Herb talked to her, then cajoled, finally demanded. It did no good. She showed him the letters of her correspondence in Jesus, most of them scrawled and full of misspellings, all of them supporting her stand and promising to pray for her. One of them was from a lady in Rhode Island who had also been at the farm in Vermont, waiting for the end of the world, along with her pet Pomeranian, Otis. "God is the best medicine," this lady wrote. "Ask God and you will be healed. Not doctors who usurp the power of God. It is doctors who have caused all the cancer in this evil world with their devil's meddling. Anyone who has had surgery, for instance, even minor, like tonsils out, sooner or later they will end up with cancer. This is a proven fact. So ask God, pray God, merge your will with His will, and you will be healed." Herb talked to Johnny on the phone, and the next day Johnny called his mother and apologized for being so short with her. He asked her to please start taking the medicine again, for him. Vera accepted his apology, but refused to go back to the medication. If God needed her treading the earth, then he would see she continued to tread it. If God wanted to call her home, he would do that, even if she took a barrel of pills a day. It was a seamless argument, and Johnny's only possible rebuttal was the one that Catholics and Protestants alike have rejected for 1,800 years. That God works his will through the mind of man as well as through the spirit of man. "Mama," he said, "haven't you thought that God's will was for some doctor to invent that drug so you could live longer? Can't you even consider that idea?" Long distance was no medium for theological argument. She hung up. The next day, Marie Michaud came into Johnny's room, put her head on his bed, and wept. "Here, here," Johnny said, startled and alarmed. "What's this? What's wrong?"
"My boy," she said, still crying. "My Mark. They operated on him, and it was just like you said. He's fine. He's going to see out of his bad eye again. Thank God."
She hugged Johnny, and he hugged her back as best he could. With her warm tears on his own cheek, he thought that whatever had happened to him wasn't all bad. Maybe something should be told, or seen, or found again. It wasn't even so far-fetched to think that God was working through him, although his own concept of God was fuzzy and ill-defined. He held Marie and told her how glad he was. He told her to remember that he wasn't the one who had operated on Mark, and that he barely remembered what it was he had told her. She left shortly after that, drying her eyes as she went, leaving Johnny alone to think.
3.
Early in August, Dave Pelson came to see Johnny. The Cleves Mills High assistant principal was a small, neat man who wore thick glasses and hush puppies and a series of loud sports jackets. Of all the people who came to see Johnny during that almost endless summer of 1975, Dave had changed the least. The gray was speckled a little more fully through his hair, but that was all. "So how are you doing, really?" Dave asked, when they had finished the amenities. "Not so bad," Johnny said. "I can walk alone now if I don't overdo it. I can swim 6 laps in the pool. I get headaches sometimes, real killers. But the doctors say I can expect that to go on for some time, maybe the rest of my life." "Mind a personal question?" "If you're going to ask me if I can still get it up," Johnny said with a grin. "That's affirmative." "That's good to know. But what I wanted to know about is the money. Can you pay for this?" Johnny shook his head. "I've been in the hospital for going on 5 years. No one but a Rockefeller could pay for that. My father and mother got me into some sort of state-funded program. Total Disaster or something like that." Dave nodded. "The Extraordinary Disaster Program. I figured that. But how did they keep you out of the state hospital, Johnny? That place is the pits." "Dr. Wyzak and Dr. Brown saw to that, and they're largely responsible for my having been able to come back as far as I have. I was a guinea pig, Dr. Wyzak says. How long can we keep this comatose man from turning into a total vegetable? The physical therapy unit was working on me the last 2 years I was in coma.
I had mega vitamin shots. My ass still looks like a case of smallpox. Not that they expected any return on the project from me personally. I was assumed to be a terminal case almost from the time I came in. Wyzak says that what he and Brown did with me is aggressive life support. He thinks it's the beginning of a response to all the criticism about sustaining life after hope of recovery is gone. Anyway, they couldn't continue to use me if I'd gone over to the state hospital, so they kept me here. Eventually, they would have finished with me, and then I would have gone to the state hospital. But the most sophisticated care you would have gotten would have been a turn every 6 hours to prevent bed sores, Dave said. And if you'd waked up in 1980, you would have been a basket case.
I think I would have been a basket case no matter what, Johnny said. He shook his head slowly. I think if someone proposes one more operation on me, I'll go nuts. And I'm still gonna have a limp, and I'll never be able to turn my head all the way to the left. When are they letting you out?
In 3 weeks, God willing.
Then what?
Johnny shrugged.
I'm going down home, I guess, to Pownell.
My mother's gonna be in California for a while on a religious thing. Dad and I can use the time to get reacquainted.
I got a letter from one of the big literary agents in New York. Well, not him exactly, but one of his assistants. They think there might be a book in what happened to me. I thought I'd try to do 2 or 3 chapters and an outline. Maybe this guy or his assistant can sell it. The money would come in pretty damn handy. No kidding there.
Has there been any other media interest?
Well, the guy from the Bangor Daily News who did the original story.
Bright?
He's good. He'd like to come down to Pownell after I blow this joint and do a feature story. I like the guy, but right now, I'm holding him off. There's no money in it for me, and right now, frankly, that's what I'm looking for. I'd go on to tell the truth if I thought I could make $200 out of it. My folks' savings are gone. They sold their car and bought a clunker. Dad took a second mortgage on the house when he should have been thinking about retiring and selling it and living on the proceeds.
Have you thought about coming back into teaching?
Johnny glanced up.
Is that an offer?
It ain't chopped liver.
I'm grateful, Johnny said. But I'm just not going to be ready in September, Dave.
I wasn't thinking about September. You must remember Sarah's friend, Ann Strafford.
Johnny nodded.
Well, she's Ann Beatty now, and she's going to have a baby in December. So we need an English teacher second semester. Light schedule. 4 classes. 1 senior study hall, 2 free periods.
Are you making a firm offer, Dave?
Firm.
That's pretty damn good of you, Johnny said hoarsely.
Hell with that, Dave said easily. You are a pretty damn good teacher.
Can I have a couple of weeks to think it over?
Until the 1st of October, if you want, Dave said. You'll still be able to work on your book, I think, if it looks like there might be a possibility there.
Johnny nodded.
And you might not want to stay down there in Pownell too long, Dave said. You might find it uncomfortable. Words rose to Johnny's lips, and he had to choke them off.
Not for long, Dave. You see, my mother is in the process of blowing her brains out right now. She's just not using a gun. She's going to have a stroke. She'll be dead before Christmas unless my father and I can persuade her to start taking her medicine again. And I don't think we can. And I'm part of it. How much of a part of it, I don't know. I don't think I want to know.
Instead, he replied, "News travels, huh?"
Dave shrugged.
"I understand through Sarah that your mother has had problems adjusting. She'll come around, Johnny. In the meantime, think about it."
"I will. In fact, I'll give you a tentative yes right now. It would be good to teach again, to get back to normal."
"You're my man," Dave said.
After he left, Johnny lay down on his bed and looked out the window. He was very tired.
Get back to normal.
Somehow, he didn't think that was ever really going to happen. He felt one of his headaches coming on.
4. The fact that Johnny Smith had come out of his coma with something extra finally did get into the paper. And it made page 1 under David Bright's byline.
It happened less than a week before Johnny left the hospital. He was in physical therapy, lying on his back on a floor pad. Resting on his belly was a 12-pound medicine ball. His physical therapist, Eileen McGowan, was standing above him and counting off sit-ups. He was supposed to do 10 of them, and he was currently struggling over number 8. Sweat was streaming down his face, and the healing scars on his neck stood out bright red. Eileen was a small, homely woman with a whipcord body, a nimbus of gorgeous, frizzy red hair, and deep green eyes flecked with hazel. Johnny sometimes called her, with a mixture of irritation and amusement, the world's smallest marine DI. She had ordered and cajoled and demanded him back from a bedfast patient who could barely hold a glass of water to a man who could walk without a cane, do 3 chin-ups at a time, and do a complete turnaround the hospital pool in 53 seconds. Not Olympic time, but not bad. She was unmarried and lived in a big house on Center Street in Old Town with her 4 cats. She was slate hard, and she wouldn't take no for an answer. Johnny collapsed backward. Nope, he panted. Oh, I don't think so, Eileen. Up, boy! She cried in high and sadistic good humor. Up, up! Just 3 more and you can have a Coke. Give me my 10-pound ball and I'll give you 2 more. That 10-pound ball is going into the Guinness Book of Records as the world's biggest suppository if you don't give me 3 more. Up! Ugh! Johnny cried, jerking through number 8. He flopped back down, then jerked up again. Great! Eileen cried. One more! One more! Orange! Johnny screamed and sat up for the 10th time. He collapsed to the mat, letting the medicine ball roll away. I ruptured myself. Are you happy? All my guts just came loose. They're floating around inside me. I'll sue you, you goddamn harpy. Jeez, what a baby, Eileen said, offering him her hand. This is nothing compared to what I've got on for next time. Forget it, Johnny said. All I'm going to do next time is swim in the... He looked at her, an expression of surprise spreading over his face. His grip tightened on her hand until it was almost painful. Johnny, what's wrong? Is it a Charlie horse? Oh, gosh, Johnny said mildly. Johnny? He was still gripping her hand, looking into her face with a faraway, dreamy contemplation that made her feel nervous. She had heard things about Johnny Smith, rumors that she had disregarded with her own brand of hard-headed Scots pragmatism. There was a story that he had predicted Marie Michaud's boy was going to be all right, even before the doctors were 100% sure they wanted to try the risky operation. Another rumor had something to do with Dr. Wyzak. It was said Johnny had told him his mother was not dead, but living someplace on the West Coast under another name. As far as Eileen McGowan was concerned, the stories were so much eyewash, on par with the confession magazines and sweet savage love stories so many nurses read on station. But the way he was looking at her now made her feel afraid. It was as if he was looking inside her. Johnny, are you okay? They were alone in the physical therapy room. The big double doors with the frosted glass panels which gave on the pool area were closed. Gosh sakes, Johnny said. You better. Yes, there's still time. Just about. What are you talking about? He snapped out of it then. He let go of her hand, but he had gripped it tightly enough to leave white indentations along the back. Call the fire department, he said. You forgot to turn off the burner. The curtains are catching on fire. What? The burner caught the dish towel, and the dish towel caught the curtains, Johnny said impatiently. Hurry up and call them. Do you want your house to burn down?
Johnny, you can't know.
Never mind what I can't know, Johnny said, grabbing her elbow. He got her moving and then walked across to the doors. Johnny was limping badly on his left leg, as he always did when he was tired. They crossed the room that housed the swimming pool, their heels clacking hollowly on the tiles, then went out to the first floor hallway and down to the nurse's station. Inside, 2 nurses were drinking coffee and a 3rd was on the phone, telling someone on the other end how she had redone her apartment. Are you going to call or should I? Johnny asked. Eileen's mind was in a whirl. Her morning routine was as set as a single person's is apt to be. She had gotten up and boiled herself a single egg while she ate a whole grapefruit, unsweetened, and a bowl of all bran. After breakfast, she had dressed and driven to the hospital. Had she turned off the burner? Of course she had. She couldn't specifically remember doing it, but it was a habit. She must have. Johnny, really, I don't know where you got the idea.
Okay, I will.
They were in the nurse's station now, a glassed-in booth furnished with three straight-back chairs and a hot plate. The little room was dominated by the call board, rows of small lights that flashed red when a patient pushed his call button. Three of them were flashing now. The two nurses went on drinking their coffee and talking about some doctor who had turned up drunk at Benjamin's. The third was apparently talking with her beautician. "Pardon me, I have to make a call," Johnny said. The nurse covered the phone with her hand. "There's a payphone in the lo-" "Thanks," Johnny said, and took the phone out of her hand. He pushed for one of the open lines and dialed zero. He got a busy signal.
"What's wrong with this thing?"
"Hey," the nurse who had been talking to her beautician cried. "What the hell do you think you're doing? Give me that." Johnny remembered that he was in a hospital with its own switchboard and dialed 9 for an outside line. Then he redialed the 0. The deposed nurse, her cheeks flaming with anger, grabbed for the phone. Johnny pushed her away. She whirled, saw Eileen, and took a step toward her.
"Eileen, what's with this crazy guy?" she asked stridently.
The other two nurses had put down their coffee cups and were staring gape-mouthed at Johnny. Eileen shrugged uncomfortably.
"I don't know. He just..."
"Operator!" "Operator, I want to report a fire in Old Town," Johnny said. "Can you give me the correct number to call, please?"
"Hey," one of the nurses said, "whose house is on fire?"
Eileen shifted her feet nervously.
"He says mine is."
The nurse, who had been talking about her apartment to her beautician, did a double take.
"Oh my God, it's that guy," she said.
Johnny pointed at the call board, where 5 or 6 lights were flashing now.
"Why don't you go see what those people want?"
The operator had connected him with the Old Town Fire Department.
"My name is John Smith, and I need to report a fire. It's at..."
He looked at Eileen.
"What's your address?"
For a moment, Johnny didn't think she was going to tell him. Her mouth worked, but nothing came out. The two coffee drinkers had now forsaken their cups and withdrawn to the station's far corner. They were whispering together like little girls in a grammar school John. Their eyes were wide.
"Sir?"
the voice on the other end asked.
"Come on," Johnny said. "Do you want your cats to fry?"
624 Center Street, Eileen said reluctantly.
"Johnny, you've wigged out."
Johnny repeated the address into the phone.
"It's in the kitchen."
"Your name, sir?"
"John Smith. I'm calling from the Eastern Maine Medical Center in Bangor."
"May I ask how you came by your information?"
"We'd be on the phone for the rest of the day. My information is correct. Now go put it out."
He banged the phone down.
"And he said Sam Wysak's mother was still..."
She broke off and looked at Johnny. For a moment he felt all of them looking at him, their eyes lying on his skin like tiny, hot weights, and he knew what would come of this, and it made his stomach turn.
"Eileen," he said.
"What?"
"Do you have a friend next door?"
Yes, Bert and Janice are next door."
"Either of them home?"
"I guess Janice probably would be, sure."
"Why don't you give her a call?"
Eileen nodded, suddenly understanding what he was getting at. She took the phone from his hand and dialed an 827 exchange number. The nurses stood by watching avidly, as if they had stepped into a really exciting TV program by accident.
"Hello, Jan? It's Eileen. Are you in your kitchen? Would you take a look out your window and tell me if everything looks, well, all right over at my place? Well, a friend of mine says..."
"I'll tell you after you go look, okay?"
Eileen was blushing.
"Yes, I'll wait."
She looked at Johnny and repeated, "You've wigged out, Johnny."
There was a pause that seemed to go on and on. Then Eileen began listening again. She listened for a long time, and then said in a strange, subdued voice, totally unlike her usual one,
"No, that's all right, Jan. They've been called. No, I can't explain right now, but I'll tell you later."
She looked at Johnny.
"Yes, it is funny how I could have known, but I can explain. At least I think I can. Goodbye."
She hung up the telephone. They all looked at her, the nurses with avid curiosity, Johnny with only dull certainty.
"Jan says there's smoke pouring out of my kitchen window," Eileen said. And all three nurses sighed in unison.
Their eyes, wide and somehow accusing, turned to Johnny again.
jury's eyes, he thought dismally. I ought to go home, Eileen said. The aggressive, cajoling, positive physical therapist was gone, replaced by a small woman who was worried about her cats and her house and her things. I don't know how to thank you, Johnny. I'm sorry I didn't believe you, but... She began to weep. One of the nurses moved toward her, but Johnny was there first. He put an arm around her and led her out into the hall.
You really can, Eileen whispered. What they said.
You go on, Johnny said. I'm sure it's going to be fine. There's going to be some minor smoke and water damage, and that's all. The movie poster from Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. I think you're going to lose that, but that's all.
Yes, okay. Thank you, Johnny. God bless you.
She kissed him on the cheek, and then began to trot down the hall. She looked back once, and the expression on her face was very much like superstitious dread. The nurses were lined up against the glass of the nurse's station, staring at him. Suddenly, they reminded him of crows on a telephone line, crows staring down at something bright and shiny, something to be pecked at and pulled apart. Go on and answer your calls, he said crossly, and they flinched back at the sound of his voice. He began to limp up the hall toward the elevator, leaving them to start the gossip on its way. He was tired. His legs hurt. His hip joints felt as if they had broken glass in them. He wanted to go to bed. Chapter 11 1 What are you going to do? Sam Wyzak asked.
Christ, I don't know, Johnny said. How many did you say are down there?
About 8. One of them is the Northern New England AP stringer. And there are people from 2 of the TV stations with cameras and lights. The hospital director is quite angry with you, Johnny. He feels you have been naughty.
Because a lady's house was going to burn down, Johnny asked.
All I can say is it must have been one friggin' slow news day. As a matter of fact, it wasn't. Ford vetoed 2 bills, the PLO blew up a restaurant in Tel Aviv, and a police dog sniffed out 400 pounds of marijuana at the airport.
Then what are they doing here? Johnny asked.
When Sam had come in with the news that reporters were gathering in the lobby, his first sinking thought was what his mother might make of this. She was with his father in Pownal, making ready for a California pilgrimage, which began the following week. Neither Johnny nor his father believed the trip was a good idea, and the news that her son had somehow turned psychic might make her cancel it. But in this case, Johnny was very much afraid that the cure might be the greater of 2 evils. Something like this could set her off for good. On the other hand, this thought suddenly blossomed in his mind with all the force of inspiration. It might persuade her to start taking her medicine again.
They're here because what happened is news, Sam said. It has all the classic ingredients.
I didn't do anything, I just...
You just told Eileen McGowan her house was on fire, and it was, Sam said softly. Come on, Johnny. You must have known this was going to happen sooner or later.
I'm no publicity hound, Johnny said grimly.
No, I didn't mean to suggest you were. An earthquake is no publicity hound, but the reporters cover it. People want to know.
What if I just refuse to talk to them?
That is not much of an option, Sam replied. They'll go away and publish crazy rumors. Then when you leave the hospital, they will fall on you. They will shove microphones in your face as if you are a senator or a crime boss, no?
Johnny thought about it. Is Bright down there?
Yes.
Suppose I ask him to come up. He can get the story and give it to the rest of them.
You can do that, but it would make the rest of them extremely unhappy, and an unhappy reporter will be your enemy. Nixon made them unhappy, and they tore him to pieces.
I'm not Nixon, Johnny said.
Wyzak grinned radiantly.
Thank God, he said.
What do you suggest, Johnny asked.
2 The reporters stood up and crowded forward when Johnny stepped through the swing doors and into the west lobby. He was wearing a white shirt, open at the collar, and a pair of blue jeans that were too big for him. His face was pale but composed. The scars from the tendon operation stood out clearly on his neck. Flashbacks popped warm fire at him and made him wince. Questions were babbled.
Here, here,
Sam Wysak shouted. This is a convalescent patient. He wants to make a brief statement, and he will answer some of your questions, but only if you behave in an orderly fashion. Now fall back and let him breathe.
Two sets of TV light bars flashed on, bathing the lobby in an unearthly glare. Doctors and nurses gathered by the lounge doorway to watch. Johnny winced away from the lights, wondering if this was what they meant by the limelight. He felt as if all of it might be a dream.
Who are you? One of the reporters yelled at Wysak. I am Samuel Wysak, this young man's doctor, and that name is spelled with two X's.
There was general laughter, and the mood eased a little.
Johnny, you feel all right? Wysak asked.
It was early evening, and his sudden insight that Eileen McGowan's kitchen was catching fire seemed distant and unimportant. The memory of a memory. Sure, he said.
What's your statement? One of the reporters called.
Well, Johnny said, it's this. My physical therapist is a woman named Eileen McGowan. She's a very nice lady, and she's been helping me get my strength back. I was in an accident, you see, and... One of the TV cameras moved in, goggling at him blankly, throwing him off stride for a moment. And I got pretty weak. My muscles sort of collapsed. We were in the physical therapy room this morning, just finishing up, and I got the feeling that her house was on fire. That is, to be more specific,
Jesus, you sound like an asshole.
I felt that she'd forgotten to turn off her stove and that the curtains in the kitchen were about to catch fire, so we just went and called the fire department, and that's all there was to it.
There was a moment's gaping pause as they digested that.
I sort of got the feeling, and that's all there was to it. And then the barrage of questions came again, everything mixed together into a meaningless stew of human voices. Johnny looked around helplessly, feeling disoriented and vulnerable.
One at a time, Wysak yelled. Raise your hands. Were you never school children?
Hands waved, and Johnny pointed at David Bright.
Would you call this a psychic experience, Johnny?
I would call it a feeling, Johnny answered. I was doing sit-ups, and I finished. Miss McGowan took my hand to help me up, and I just knew.
He pointed at someone else.
Mel Allen, Portland Sunday Telegram, Mr. Smith. Was it like a picture? A picture in your head?
No, not at all, Johnny said. But he was not really able to remember what it had been like. Has this happened to you before, Johnny? A young woman in a slack suit asked.
Yes, a few times.
Can you tell us about the other incidents?
No, I'd rather not.
One of the TV reporters raised his hand and Johnny nodded at him.
Did you have any of these flashes before your accident and the resulting coma, Mr. Smith?
Johnny hesitated. The room seemed very still. The TV lights were warm on his face, like a tropical sun.
No, he said.
Another barrage of questions. Johnny looked helplessly at Wysak again.
Stop, stop, he bellowed.
He looked at Johnny as the roar subsided. You are done, Johnny?
I'll answer two more questions, Johnny said. Then, really, it's been a long day for me.
Yes, ma'am. He was pointing to a stout woman who had wedged herself in between two young reporters.
Mr. Smith, she said in a loud, carrying, tuba-like voice. Who will be the Democrats' nominee for president next year?
I can't tell you that, Johnny said, honestly surprised at the question. How could I tell you that?
More hands were raised. Johnny pointed to a tall, sober-faced man in a dark suit. He took one step forward. There was something prim and coiled about him.
Mr. Smith, I'm Roger Dussault from the Lewiston Sun, and I would like to know if you have any idea why you should have such an extraordinary ability as this, if indeed you do. Why you, Mr. Smith?
Johnny cleared his throat. As I understand your question, you're asking me to justify something I don't understand. I can't do that.
Not justify, Mr. Smith, just explain.
He thinks I'm hoaxing them, or trying. Wysak stepped up beside Johnny.
I wonder if I might answer that, he said, or at least attempt to explain why it cannot be answered.
Are you psychic too? Dussault asked coldly.
Yes, all neurologists must be. It's a requirement.
Wyzak said. There was a burst of laughter, and Dussault flushed. Ladies and gentlemen of the press, this man spent 4.5 years in a coma. We who study the brain have no idea why he did, or why he came out of it. And this is for the simple reason that we do not understand what a coma really is, any more than we understand sleep or the simple act of waking. Ladies and gentlemen, we do not understand the brain of a frog or the brain of an ant. You may quote me on these things. You see, I am fearless, no? More laughter. They liked Wyzak, but Dussault did not laugh. You may also quote me as saying, I believe that this man is now in possession of a very new human ability, or a very old one. Why? If I and my colleague do not understand the brain of an ant, can I tell you why? I cannot. I can suggest some interesting things to you, however. Things which may or may not have bearing. A part of John Smith's brain has been damaged beyond repair. A very small part, but all parts of the brain may be vital. He calls this his dead zone, and there, apparently, a number of trace memories were stored. All of these wiped out memories seem to be part of a set, that of street, road, and highway designations. A subset of a larger overall set, that of where is it? This is a small but total aphasia, which seems to include both language and visualization skills. Balancing this off, another tiny part of John Smith's brain appears to have awakened, a section of the cerebrum within the parietal lobe. This is one of the deeply grooved sections of the forward or thinking brain. The electrical responses for this section of Smith's brain are way out of line from what they should be, no? Here's one more thing. The parietal lobe has something to do with the sense of touch. How much or how little, we are not completely sure. And it is very near to that area of the brain that sorts and identifies various shapes and textures. And it has been my own observation that John's flashes are always preceded by some sort of touching. Silence. Reporters were scribbling madly. The TV cameras, which had moved in to focus on Wyzak, now pulled back to include Johnny in the picture. Is that it, Johnny? Wyzak asked again.
I guess.
Dussault suddenly shouldered his way through the knot of reporters. For a bemused moment, Johnny thought he was going to join them in front of the doors, possibly for the purpose of rebuttal. Then he saw that Dussault was slipping something from around his neck. Let's have a demonstration, he said. He was holding a medallion on a fine-link gold chain. Let's see what you can do with this. We'll see no such thing, Wyzak said. His bushy salt-and-pepper eyebrows had drawn thunderously together, and he stared down at Dussault like Moses. This man is not a carnival performer, sir. You sure could have fooled me, Dussault said. Either he can or he can't, right? While you were busy suggesting things, I was busy suggesting something to myself. What I was suggesting was that these guys can never perform on demand because they're all as genuine as a pile of $3 bills. Johnny looked at the other reporters. Except for Bright, who looked rather embarrassed, they were watching avidly. Suddenly he felt like a Christian in a pit full of lions. They went either way, he thought. If I can tell them something, they've got a front page story. If I can't, or if I refuse to try, they've got another kind of story. Well, Dussault asked. The medallion swung back and forth below his fist. Johnny looked at Wyzak, but Wyzak was looking away, disgusted. Give it to me, Johnny said. Dussault handed it over. Johnny put the medallion in his palm. It was a St. Christopher medal. He dropped the fine link chain on top of it in a crisp little yellow heap and closed his hand over it. Dead silence fell in the room. The handful of doctors and nurses standing by the lounge doorway had been joined by a half a dozen others, some of them dressed in street clothes and on their way out of the hospital for the night. A crowd of patients had gathered at the end of the hallway, leading to the first floor TV and game lounge. The people who had come for the regular early evening visiting hours had drifted over from the main lobby. A feeling of thick tension lay in the air, like a humming power cable.
Johnny stood silently, pale and thin in his white shirt and oversized blue jeans. The St. Christopher medal was clamped so tightly in his right hand that the cords in his wrist stood out clearly in the glare of the TV light bars. In front of him, sober, impeccable, and judgmental in his dark suit, Dassault stood in the adversary position. The moment seemed to stretch out interminably. No one coughed or whispered.
"Oh," Johnny said softly. Then, "Is that it?"
His fingers loosened slowly. He looked at Dassault.
"Well?"
Dassault asked, but the authority was suddenly gone from his voice. The tired, nervous young man who had answered the reporter's question seemed also to be gone. There was a half-smile on Johnny's lips, but there was nothing warm about it. The blue of his eyes had darkened. They had grown cold and distant. Wyzak saw it and felt a chill of goose flesh. He later told his wife that it had been the face of a man looking through a high-powered microscope and observing an interesting species of paramecium.
"It's your sister's medallion," he said to Dassault. "Her name was Anne, but everyone called her Terry. Your older sister. You loved her. You almost worshipped the ground she walked on."
Suddenly, terribly, Johnny Smith's voice began to climb and change. It became the cracked and unsure voice of an adolescent.
"It's for when you cross Lisbon Street against the lights, Terry. Or when you're parking with one of those guys from EL. Don't forget, Terry. Don't forget."
The plump woman who had asked Johnny who the Democrats would nominate next year uttered a frightened little moan. One of the TV cameramen muttered,
"Holy Jesus,"
in a hoarse voice.
"Stop it,"
Dassault whispered. His face had gone a sick shade of gray. His eyes bulged and spittle shone like chrome on his lower lip in this harsh light. His hands moved for the medallion, which was now looped on its fine gold chain over Johnny's fingers. But his hands moved with no power or authority. The medallion swung back and forth, throwing off hypnotic gleams of light.
"Remember me, Terry,"
the adolescent voice begged.
"Stay clean, Terry. Please. For God's sake, stay clean."
"Stop it. Stop it, you bastard."
Now Johnny spoke in his own voice again.
"It was speed, wasn't it? Then meth. She died of a heart attack at 27. But she wore it 10 years, Raj. She remembered you. She never forgot. Never forgot. Never, never, never."
The medallion slipped from his fingers and struck the floor with a small, musical sound. Johnny stared away into emptiness for a moment, his face calm and cool and distant. Dassault grubbed at his feet for the medallion, sobbing hoarsely in the stunned silence. A flashback popped, and Johnny's face cleared and became his own again. Horror touched it, and then pity. He knelt clumsily beside Dassault.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I'm sorry, I didn't mean—"
"You cheap jack bastard hoaxer!"
Dassault screamed at him. "It's a lie! All a lie! All a lie!" He struck Johnny a clumsy, open-handed blow on the neck, and Johnny fell over, striking his head on the floor hard. He saw stars. Uproar. He was dimly aware that Dassault was pushing his way blindly through the crowd and toward the doors. People milled around Dassault, around Johnny. He saw Dassault through a forest of legs and shoes. Then Wyzak was beside him, helping him to sit up.
"John, are you all right? Did he hurt you?"
"Not as bad as I hurt him. I'm okay."
He struggled to his feet. Hands, maybe Wyzak's, maybe someone else's, helped him. He felt dizzy and sick, almost revolted. This had been a mistake. A terrible mistake. Someone screamed piercingly. The stout woman who had asked about the Democrats. Johnny saw Dassault pitch forward to his knees, grope at the sleeve of the stout woman's print blouse, and then slide tiredly forward onto the tile near the doorway he'd been trying to reach. The St. Christopher medal was still in one hand.
"Fainted," someone said. "Fainted dead away, I'll be damned."
"My fault," Johnny said to Sam Wyzak. His throat felt close and tight with shame, with tears. "All my fault."
"No," Sam said. "No, John."
But it was. He shook loose of Wyzak's hands
and went to where Dussault lay, coming around now, eyes blinking dazedly at the ceiling. Two of the doctors had come over to where he lay.
"Is he all right?" Johnny asked.
He turned toward the woman reporter in the slack suit, and she shrank away from him. A cramp of fear passed over her face. Johnny turned the other way, toward the TV reporter, who had asked him if he'd had any flashes before his accident. It suddenly seemed very important that he explain to someone.
"I didn't mean to hurt him," he said. "Honest to God, I never meant to hurt him. I didn't know."
The TV reporter backed up a step.
"No," he said. "Of course he didn't. He was asking for it. Anybody could see that. Just don't touch me, huh?"
Johnny looked at him dumbly, lips quivering. He was still in shock, but beginning to understand. Oh, yes. He was beginning to understand. The TV reporter tried to smile and could only produce a death's head rictus.
"Just don't touch me, Johnny. Please."
"It's not like that," Johnny said, or tried to. Later, he was never sure if any sound had come out.
"Don't touch me, Johnny, okay?"
The reporter backed up to where his cameraman was packing his gear. Johnny stood and watched him. He began to shake all over.
3. "It's for your own good, John," Wyzak said. The nurse stood behind him, a white ghost, a sorcerer's apprentice with her hands hovering above the small, wheeled medication table, a junkie's paradise of sweet dreams.
"No," Johnny said. He was still shaking, and now there was cold sweat as well. "No more shots. I've had it up to here with shots."
"A pill, then?"
"No more pills, either.
To help you sleep."
"Will he be able to sleep? That man Dussault?"
"He asked for it," the nurse murmured, and then flinched as Wyzak turned toward her. But Wyzak smiled crookedly.
"She is right now," he said. "The man asked for it. He thought you were selling empty bottles, John. A good night's sleep, and you'll be able to put this in perspective."
"I'll sleep on my own."
"Johnny, please."
It was 11:15. The TV across the room had just gone off. Johnny and Sam watched the filmed story together. It had been second-lined right after the bills Ford had vetoed.
My own story made much better theater, Johnny thought with morbid amusement.
Film footage of a bald-headed Republican mouthing platitudes about the national budget just didn't compare with the film clip that WABI cameraman had gotten here earlier this evening. The clip had ended with Dussault plunging across the floor with his sister's medal clutched in his hand, and then crashing down in a faint, clutching at the woman reporter the way a drowning man might clutch at a straw. When the TV anchorman went on to the police dog and the 400 pounds of pot, Wyzak had left briefly and come back with the news that the hospital switchboard had jammed up with calls for him even before the report was over. The nurse with the medication had shown up a few minutes later, leading Johnny to believe that Sam had gone down to the nurse's station to do more than check on incoming calls. At that instant, the telephone rang. Wyzak swore softly under his breath.
"I told them to hold them all. Don't answer it, John. I'll..."
But Johnny already had it. He listened for a moment, then nodded.
"Yes, that was right."
He put a hand over the receiver. "It's my dad," he said. He uncovered the receiver.
"Hi, Dad. I guess you..."
He listened. The small smile on his lips faded and was replaced by an expression of dawning horror. His lips moved silently.
"John, what is it?" Wyzak asked sharply. "All right, Daddy," Johnny said, almost in a whisper. "Yes, Cumberland General. I know where it is. Just above Jerusalem's lot. Okay. All right. Daddy," his voice broke. His eyes were tearless but glistening. "I know, Daddy. I love you too. I'm sorry."
"Listened."
"Yes. Yes, it was," Johnny said. "I'll see you, Daddy. Yes. Goodbye."
He hung up the phone, put the heels of his hands to his eyes, and pressed. "Johnny?" Sam leaned forward, took one of his hands away, and held it gently.
"Is it your mother?"
"Yeah, it's my mother."
"Heart attack?"
"Stroke," Johnny said.
and Sam Wysack made a small, pained hissing between his teeth. They were watching the TV news. Neither of them had any idea, and I came on, and she had a stroke. Christ. She's in the hospital. Now if something happens to my dad, we got a triple play. He uttered a high scream of laughter. His eyes rolled wildly from Sam to the nurse and back to Sam again.
It's a good talent, he said. Everybody should have it.
The laugh came again, so like a scream.
How bad is she? Sam asked. He doesn't know.
Johnny swung his legs out of bed. He had changed back to a hospital gown and his feet were bare.
What do you think you are doing? Sam asked sharply. What does it look like?
Johnny got up, and for a moment it seemed that Sam would push him back onto the bed, but he only watched Johnny limp over to the closet.
Don't be ridiculous. You're not ready for this, John.
Unmindful of the nurse, they had seen his bare tail enough times, God knew, Johnny let the gown drop around his feet. The thick, twisting scars stood out on the backs of his knees and dimpled into the scant swell of his calves. He began to rummage in the closet for clothes and came up with the white shirt and jeans he had worn to the news conference.
John, I absolutely forbid this. As your doctor and your friend, I tell you, it is madness.
Forbid all you want. I'm going, Johnny said. He began to dress. His face wore that expression of distant preoccupation that Sam associated with his trances. The nurse gawped.
Nurse, you might as well go back to your station, Sam said.
She backed to the door and stood there for a moment, and then left, reluctantly.
Johnny, Sam said. He got up, went to him, and put a hand on his shoulder.
You didn't do it.
Johnny shook the hand off. I did it all right, he said. She was watching me when it happened.
He began to button the shirt.
You urged her to take her medicine, and she stopped.
Johnny looked at Wysack for a moment, and then went back to buttoning his shirt.
If it hadn't happened tonight, it would have happened tomorrow, next week, next month, or next year, or in 10 years.
No, it would not have been 10 years, or even one, and you know it.
Why are you so anxious to pin this tale on yourself? Because of that smug reporter? Is it maybe an inverted kind of self-pity, an urge to believe that you have been cursed?
Johnny's face twisted.
She was watching me when it happened. Don't you get that? Are you so fucking soft you don't get that?
She was planning a strenuous trip all the way to California and back. You told me that yourself. A symposium of some kind? A highly emotional sort of thing from what you have said? Yes?
Yes. It would almost certainly have happened then. A stroke is not lightning from a blue sky, Johnny.
Johnny buttoned the jeans and then sat down as if the act of dressing had tired him out too much to do more. His feet were still bare.
Yeah, he said. Yeah, you may be right. Sense! He sees sense, thank the Lord!
But I still have to go, Sam.
Wysack threw his hands up. And do what? She's in the hands of her doctor and her God. That is the situation. Better than anyone else, you must understand.
My dad will need me, Johnny said softly. I understand that, too.
How will you go? It's nearly midnight.
By bus. I'll grab a cab over to Peter's Candlelighter. The Greyhounds still stop there, don't they?
You don't have to do that, Sam said.
Johnny was groping under the chair for his shoes and not finding them. Sam got them from under the bed and handed them to him.
I'll drive you down.
Johnny looked up at him.
You do that?
If you'll take a mild tranquilizer, yes.
But your wife?
He realized in a confused sort of way that the only concrete thing he knew about Wysack's personal life was that his mother was living in California.
I am divorced, Wysack said. A doctor has to be out all hours of the night, unless he is a podiatrist or a dermatologist, no? My wife saw the bed as half empty rather than half full, so she filled it with a variety of men.
I'm sorry, Johnny said, embarrassed.
You spend far too much time being sorry, John.
Sam's face was gentle, but his eyes were stern.
Put on your shoes.
Chapter 12 1 Hospital to hospital, Johnny thought dreamily, flying gently along on the small blue pill he had taken just before he and Sam left the EMMC and climbed into Sam's 75 Eldorado. Hospital to hospital, person to person, station to station. In a queer, secret way, he enjoyed the trip. It was his first time out of the hospital in almost 5 years. The night was clear. The Milky Way sprawled across the sky in an unwinding clock spring of light. A half moon followed them over the dark tree line as they fled south through Palmyra, Newport, Pittsfield, Benton, Clinton. The car whispered along in near total silence. Low music, Haydn, issued from the four speakers of the stereo tape player. Came to one hospital in the Cleves Mills Rescue Squad ambulance. Went to another in a Cadillac, he thought. He didn't let it bother him. It was just enough to ride, to float along on the track, to let the problem of his mother, his new ability, and the people who wanted to pry into his soul, he asked for it. Just don't touch me, huh? Rest in a temporary limbo. Wyzak didn't talk. Occasionally he hummed snatches of the music. Johnny watched the stars. He watched the turnpike, nearly deserted this late. It unrolled ceaselessly in front of them. They went through the toll gate at Augusta, and Wyzak took a time and toll ticket. Then they went on again. Gardner, Sabattis, Lewiston.
Nearly 5 years. Longer than some convicted murderers spend in the slam.
He slept, dreamed.
Johnny, his mother said in his dream. Johnny, make me better. Make me well.
She was in a beggar's rags. She was crawling toward him over cobblestones. Her face was white. Thin blood ran from her knees. White lice squirmed in her thin hair. She held shaking hands out to him.
It's the power of God working in you, she said. It's a great responsibility, Johnny. A great trust. You must be worthy.
He took her hands, closed his own over them, and said, Spirits, depart from this woman. She stood up.